Good morning. We don't have a gavel, so that was my hand, just in case you were wondering why it was so weak sounded. We do have a quorum, so we will. I will officially call this our legacy committee to order, seeing that a quorum is present. We have several members that are zooming in due to the beautiful March 5th snow day that we have here in Minnesota. So, with that said, welcome for all those who traveled to the icy roads and snow roads. I'm glad you made it here safe and sound. This morning we have House File 1250, but before we do that, thank you, Ms. Zipko, we will approve. I need someone to read the minutes to make sure there's no corrections and offer an amendment to approve those.
So moved,
Mr. Chair. So moved by Vice Chair Scraba. Very good. Thank you, Vice Chair Scraba. All in favor to approve the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, thank you, Ms. Zipko. House File 1250, Representative Burkle, followed by Representative Lilly, will be presenting the Lessard-Sams Bill Outdoor Heritage Fund. So that is a leverage of certain land for federal grant funds, providing money and appropriated. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, gentlemen. Oh, yes, Representative Burkle, I believe your motion, I'm going to put words in your mouth, your motion will be to move the House File 1250 to be recommended to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Your bill is before us now, so you may proceed.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Really want to thank Representative Lilly for co-presenting with me today. We've served on Lessard-Sams together now. My first 2 years, this past two, I think you've been on five plus. Something like that.
A few.
Leon's an old hand at this. So anyway, the Outdoor Heritage Fund was formed in November of 2008 with passage of the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Constitutional Amendment. And I'm not going to go on and on, but this is the 17th year of the funding proposals. Roughly 55 proposals come before us each year. Typically asking for roughly $300 million. The council spends July through November vetting those proposals and ranking them, and by December the council has a select list of projects for funding, and that's what you see in this bill in front of you today. Many hours are spent and much staff time, and I have to thank Mark and Joe here for all the work staff does. Lots of time spent debating and reviewing these proposals. Not a perfect process by any means, but this one's a pretty darn good process in the big picture. All the Lessard-Sams council meetings are posted and open to the public, and all the work is publicly displayed on their website. So with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Lilly for a few comments, and then we can get to testifiers.
Very good, Mr. Representative Burkle. Representative Lilly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Burkle. So as a member of this committee and like Representative Burkle, we're lucky enough to be on the Lessard-Sams Council. We're appointed by our teams, and in the past I believe Representative Heitzman has served, and I've served with him I think a couple different times, and but it's quite an honor to be on there. About a third of our budget goes to Lessard-Sams and your committee here, sir, and with the legacy funds, and the proposals are thoroughly vetted by the council, and it's made up of a couple representatives, two senators, and the rest are citizens. But the proposals that he mentioned are pretty thorough. So I'm kind of old-fashioned, so I asked for a printed version. Can very much get it online, but I brought this today. So if any members want this, but Representative Burkle said, the projects are very vetted and looked at, and try to spread projects all over the state of Minnesota in enhancing our habitat and for fishing and hunting, and just some amazing projects. So I really hope members take the time to look at it, and then to listen to the staff today, and then hear the projects. I just want to say, it's an honor to be on the council with the citizens. Really, they do take it serious, and these projects are extremely well vetted and do some amazing work all over the state of Minnesota. So
Very good. Thank you, Representative Lilly. And today we are honored to have good folks from the outdoor Lasard Sam. So we have Mark Johnson, who's our executive director for the council, and Joe Pavelko, who is the assistant director. So, gentlemen, I believe that you have a presentation and going to walk through the bill with us. So you may proceed and welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, I'm Mark Johnson, the executive director of the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. Mr. Chair and members, I'll start by giving you kind of a, with your permission, I'll start by going kind of a higher level of the, or walking through the bill, not line by line, but I will point out subdivisions for you and what why they're important. And then we'll hand it over to Mr. Pavelko, and he'll kind of give you the guts of how it applies on the land, how it comes down across the state. There is a handout for you. It's a big, beautiful color handout for you to take a look at. I won't read all the front stuff for you, but that's really highlights of the bill that you can read on your own. I think it's important to say that so far over the last 16 years, what has happened so far, not all of the money has been spent, of course, because it takes a long time to spend the dollars of these in these programs, but about 1.5 million acres have already been touched across Minnesota, either protected, restored, or enhanced. So there's been a lot of work that's already happened with the Outdoor Heritage Fund appropriations that you all have seen fit to approve in the past. If I can have you turn to the bill, we'll just walk through it really quite quickly, but I really want to, when we get to the back of it, I want to make sure I call your attention to a couple things. First of all, the bill is about $168 million. It's not small. It's a lot of appropriations. But as Representative Burkle mentioned, there's about $300 million or more in ask every year. So it's a winnowing down. It's a competitive process. All of these are reimbursement, are managed on a reimbursement type basis unless otherwise pre-planned. And basically, so that means 99% of them are reimbursement basis. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Page 2 of the bill goes into subdivision 2. You see it's prairie section. Prairie section is fairly large. It's page 2 through 6 of the bill. There are 10 programs, 10 appropriations within this prairie section. All of these are prairie-related projects. So, and consequently, they happen primarily in the prairie region of the state, which pretty much runs from Albert Lea up to the west side of the metro and on up to Detroit Lakes and then north to Canada and everything west and south of that. So it's a big section of the state. Some of the there may be some prairies in the prairie forest transition zone, which is kind of a little bit north of that, but primarily these projects are going to all happen to the west and south of that. These are all repeat phases, and we'll be talking about repeat phases later on, so we'll try to highlight that a little bit for you and why it's important. If you jump to page 6 of the bill, pages 6 through 8 is a forest portion of the bill. This is for about $20 million of the appropriations, and I should have mentioned that that original prairie area was about $35 million worth of the appropriations. But in this area, there are 7 programs. One of them is brand new. One of them is a phase 2, which I think is kind of, we talk about phases, and we'll, like I mentioned, we'll chat about those later, but sometimes the dollars aren't all appropriated in phase 1. They need a phase 2, and we'll get an example of that next. We get a lot of questions about phases, and that's why I'm touching on those now, and we'll talk about them more after a bit. Of these 7 programs, they're all forest related. It's forest restoration, habitat, or potentially acquisition of forest lands. If you look on page 6, line 634, right at the bottom, the Itasca County Memorial Forest Project is an acquisition project. And that's where actually Itasca County wants to acquire some lands for a forest up there to be under county forest management. But all of these are forests, so most of them are going to take place either in the northern forest zone or in the southeast forest area of the state. Sometimes they'll come down as far as St. Cloud because of the prairie forest transition area there. If we go to page 9, we get into the wetlands portion of the bill, and that is, again, all wetland-type projects. They're restoring, enhancing, protecting wetlands across the state. There are about $30 million worth of appropriations in this wetlands portion. And much of this happens, again, in the prairie section of the state just because that's where a lot of the potholes are. It's prairie pothole. But some of them happen in other areas of the state as well. If we move to page 11 of the bill, that's subdivision 5 is the biggest portion of the appropriations. That's the habitats portion. And those are the projects or programs, they're really a mix. They may happen in different areas, but primarily it's a mix of what they're doing. Maybe they're doing some acquisition or some wetland work. They may be doing habitat restoration work as well. It may be river work as well as doing some upland. So it's a mix of habitat work that really doesn't fit precisely in either of the last three categories. And this is 22 programs. Four of them are new, 17 are repeat phases. And then I kind of want to call your attention especially to two more that are in there. And they're back on page 18 or 17. Let's see. We'll go back there if I can pull you back there. Page 18 of the bill. And it's on line 1818, the DNR roving crews. It says phase three. This is an interesting one. It's really unique. They come to the council once every 2 years. This is the third time they come back on a two-year schedule. DNR has five roving crews, I believe it is, across the state. And someday it would be wonderful to have them in here just to talk to you about what they do, although you probably won't have time. But, man, they work only on outdoor heritage projects across the state. These roving crews run from anywhere from 3 to 7 people per crew. But all the work they do is strictly habitat-related on public lands on outdoor heritage-funded projects. So really unique in what they do. This year, or in the first year after this is passed, they will work on about 26 to 28,000 acres of public lands in Minnesota, restoring or enhancing. That's their job. The next year, they'll do the same thing. And it's the council has looked at it and understands how valuable these crews are. That's why they've asked them to come back on a two-year basis for funding to continue the work. And then right below that, on line 1825, is the CPL, or Conservation Partner Legacy Grant Program. That's the small grants portion of the bill. And it's done by statute. The council is required to have a small grants portion. The small grants are anywhere from $5,000 to $500,000. Those are orchestrated and managed by the DNR. So this appropriation goes right to the DNR. And DNR has a CPL coordinator at CPL. I think it's just one person now or two people that run that program. It's $15 million. Interestingly, in this appropriation, interestingly, $4 million of that is earmarked for the metro, the metro or 7-county metropolitan area, and cities with populations of 50,000 or greater. And then another $4 million is earmarked strictly for new applicants. Now, let's say you're one of those. You're a new applicant or you're a metro applicant, and that $8 million is gone. It's all used up, and you didn't get any dollars put to you. You can still apply, or your application will still go to the rest of the funds. So there's at least a couple of chances to bite at the apple. But it's an interesting project. There is a 10% match that's required by law on this, and that's in statute. I'm going to call your attention back. We won't go through them too much, but on page 20 is the subdivision 6 is administration, and that's the budget as well as contracts management, which is dollars that go to the DNR to manage these contracts, to make sure the monies are spent like they should be and the receipts are put in for the expenditures, et cetera, and then reimbursements are made. There's also a technical evaluations panel on 21.11. That's subdivision 6C, and that panel is, again, by law, set up with the DNR and Bowser convening the panel of experts to go out and take a look at projects to make sure the restoration enhancements are done correctly. If there's something wrong with them, what is that? If there's something that's really right that we can pass on and learn from, what is it? So they're trying to grasp that knowledge and move it forward. And then subdivision 6D is core functions, which you'll hear about later, but core functions is it basically covers the expenses that DNR will acquire or will incur as they accept land, as they acquire lands with these funds, or as they accept lands that are acquired with these funds, like WMAs or AMAs. It's the land acquisition costs. It's the initial development of those properties. So let's say you buy a new AMA and it needs posting of the property with signs. That's part of these costs. If you need a parking area to make sure people park in the right spot so it's safe and it's not destroying habitat, that parking spot or parking lot is covered, et cetera. If you're doing a WMA and you're going to have conservation grazing worked with local ranchers on that property, then the fencing may be included in those initial development plans. So it's covering those initial costs. Subdivision 8 talks about the payments and conditions. The real thing to remember there is this is a reimbursement basis project or program. So everything's managed on that basis. If I can call your attention to the second to last page. So subdivision 10, it starts on 25.3. This is a carry forward section, and I want to make sure you know exactly what's happening here. Subdivision 10A is actually a one-year extension recommended by the council to ensure that the finalization of restoration of a metro trout stream by the Metro Big Rivers group. And that's a 2020 appropriation. It actually expires this summer, June 30th. This is a one-year extension to make sure that trout stream is completed. They think they'll have it completed this spring, but you always hedge on the side of weather. With trout stream restorations, they are not easy. So that's why the recommendation for that. Similar, subdivision 10B on 25.8 is a one-year extension to ensure completion of restoration and enhancement activities up in the St. Louis River Estuary or the St. Louis River Restoration Initiative. Now, those are projects up in the St. Louis River Estuary. And then on paragraph C, 25.1.3, this is actually a corrective change, one that we as LSOHC staff missed. I missed it 2 years ago. It had an expiration date that was incorrect. So this merely provides the appropriate expiration date so that the core functions has the appropriate amount of time to expend their dollars. So it would be June 30th of 31. Following subdivision 11 on 25.18 is a cancellation. And remember I mentioned the core functions. This is bring it back to that in just a second, because that's where these cancellation dollars are going to be used, in that core function appropriation on subdivision 6D. We know that there's a project down on Heron Lake in southwestern Minnesota, right on the border with Iowa. We know there's dollars that are going to be returned from that. We know it's going to be, I don't know how much it is actually, $1 million or a little more. But what the council decided was, how about if we just, rather than so we can do some rounding in the appropriation or in the recommendations for these appropriations. How about if we just cancel $120,000 of that appropriation that's not going to be used right now, bring it back so it can be used right now? And so that's what this cancellation is for. And we have worked with House Legal and House Finance and also Senate Finance and Legal to kind of work in that. And you may ask them questions on this too if you're worried about following the dollars. And the last thing is the very last portion. It's an amendment to statute 97A.056, which is the guiding statute for the outdoor heritage dollars and the council itself. And I think your staff did a really good job of summarizing that in their summary of the bill. So I'm going to read from that. In a nutshell, what this does is it allows a leveraging of federal funds without the council getting involved. It's something that's been done for years, but this is kind of a, for lack of a better term, a time-saving effort or time-saving step. So it states that an interest in real property purchased with money from the Outdoor Heritage Fund may be used to leverage federal funds from conservation programs such as Pittman-Robertson, Dingell-Johnson, also the North American Wetlands Conservation Act, and that the programs may place conditions requiring the continued use of the lands for conservation purposes. Those conditions, the council has looked at them, those conditions are perfectly in line with our statute, with our intent, with the intent of these funds and with constitutional language of the funds. So the council doesn't see a problem with this and actually recommends this amendment. What it does is it allows these recipients, if they want to leverage federal funds, they don't have to come back to the council to ask permission. So it doesn't, it means DNR doesn't have to come back to council every time they want to leverage Pittman Robertson dollars to extend or to get more bang for the buck, so to speak, because it is for conservation use of these properties. And we can get into that deeper later if you'd like, or Ms. Taylor may have some comments for you if you'd like to. With that, Mr. Chair, I will hand it over to Mr. Pavelko, who will go into the handout and give you a little more insights.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Appreciate the walkthrough as well and the descriptions. Mr. Pavelko, welcome, and you may proceed as well.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Joe Pavelko, the Assistant Director with the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. I'm going to talk about the inside of the handout, just talk about how we categorize the funding and the acres, talk about just a few interesting facts, then go to the back of the handout, talk about the some of the projects, and then also I'm going to talk about the issue or non-issue of the phase programs and just kind of try to explain the advantages and maybe the disadvantages of that. So if you turn to the inside of the handout, you can see on the right side, that's about the funding, and then the left side is about acres. We break down the activities by restore. Restore is like taking land where there's nothing there, no habitat, and bringing it back to habitat. We break it down by protect and fee with PILT. Those are lands that are going to the DNR, and DNR makes PILT payments to the counties. There's protect and fee without PILT. Those are all the lands that are going to anyone other than the DNR. The Fish and Wildlife Service does make a PILT payment. It's called a revenue sharing payment. That's not included in the protect and fee with PILT. Back then when OHF started, they thought it made more sense to just have DNR have their own category. So protect and fee without PILT will go to the Fish and Wildlife Service as waterfowl production areas, could go to counties or could go to cities. Protect and easement, that's self-explanatory. So those are all permanent conservation easements for Bowser Rim, reinvest in Minnesota. There are a lot of acres that go to Bowser. And then Minnesota Land Trust has private land conservation easements. Those are included in those. And then enhance, that's our biggest acre category, and those are taking habitat that's existing and making it better. So that would be like burning a prairie or thinning a forest or putting a water control structure on a wetland to where you can manage the water, whereas restoring a wetland would be there's no water there, we're bringing the water back. So that those are the two differences. If you look at the bottom part of that left-hand side of the handout, you can see the total acres there on the right. One thing to mention is that for protect and fee with PILT, there's 2,485 acres, and looking back at all of the stats of the 16 years that OHF has been around, that's the lowest ever for land going to the DNR, so that's with PILT. If you look one line lower, protect and fee without PILT, again, that's land going to the Fish and Wildlife or the county, there's 4,076 acres. If you remove the Itasca County project, where approximately 2,700 acres is going to Itasca County, that leaves 1,356 acres for the Fish and Wildlife and other recipients, which is also the lowest ever of the 16 years that OHF has been around. And I think that's due to a couple things. First is land availability, just that the land market is very, very tough, and also the land prices are extremely high right now. So there's just not a lot of options right now for acquisition. So, you know, these two numbers follow the land market. When there's a lot of land available, there's more opportunities, obviously. If you look on the right, talking about activities, especially with funding, though, you can see Restore has a smaller percentage of the total cost, whereas if you compare that to the acquisition, so protected fee with PILT to protected fee without PILT and easement, a majority of the money goes to those three activities compared to restore and enhance, and that's just because it's a lot cheaper to do restoration enhancement as it is to actually buy the land and then do the restoration. So if we just took an average across our entire bill, a restored acre would cost $2,570 per acre. Enhancement would cost $630 per acre. And if you look on the other extreme side of the protect and fee with PILT, it would cost $9,065 per acre. So again, it's a lot more expensive because you're buying the land and then you have the cost of actually doing the restoration. And I will call out too that when partners acquire the land and fee, they are required and expected to do the restoration. So it's not if there are those needs, they are expected to have that in their budget. We don't want folks going out buying land and letting it sit there and not provide the habitat that it's supposed to provide. So that's just a little bit about the funding and the acres of this year's bill. Going to the back of the handout, I just wanted to touch on a few of the projects that are out there. If you look at subdivision 2J, it's called Accelerating the USFWS Habitat Conservation Easement Program, Phase 5. That money is going to Ducks Unlimited and Pheasants Forever, and they're working in partnership with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And so if you're a duck hunter and you have to buy a duck stamp, those duck stamp funds are used to acquire habitat. And interestingly, and I'm not sure why this is, but I guess it's in federal statute and law, but they can't use the duck stamp money to restore the easements that they buy. So Fish and Wildlife, these working lands easements, Fish and Wildlife will acquire the easement, and then they work with Pheasants Forever and Ducks Unlimited to do the restoration on those sites. So it's a interesting partnership. One thing to note, these are working lands, so they stay, you know, as working lands, so you can you can't farm them, but you can hay them and graze them, and based on what you want to do, they get paid accordingly for those permanent, and they are permanent easements. And then Ducks Unlimited will do the restorations, the wetland restorations, Pheasants Forever will do the grassland restorations. There's a lot of tree removal on the wetlands. It's interesting that when you see trees lined around a wetland where they can't grow into the water because it's too wet, but it's those trees kind of act like water pumps, and so they suck so much water out of the wetland that it kind of not drains the wetland, but it changes the type of the wetland. So a lot of work is done to remove those trees so that there's more water in the wetlands instead of having them dry and not providing as much waterfowl habitat. Mark talked about Itasca County. Just that one thing to note, they're pretty cheap acres. Itasca County will be buying those acres and they will be enrolling it into their forest land acres, so they will be working lands forests. That property is large property. It's 2,700 acres and it's surrounded by other public lands. So in addition to providing, you know, the new acquisition, they're also providing access to those other acres that are around them. So it's a pretty strategic acquisition. If you look at subdivision 4H, DNR Accelerated Shallow Lakes and Wetland Enhancement, that's phase 17. That's money going to the DNR for the Shallow Lakes program. As everyone knows in this committee, that when you're working on wetlands and working with water, there's a lot of requirements that come with it, permitting and getting all the approvals and, you know, public meetings and all that kind of stuff. And so DNR, that money goes to their staff, and they help partners and just themselves work through that process of, you know, hey, can we even do this wetland restoration project? Is it even feasible? So they go into that, they look at it, make sure it's feasible, and then they'll help design, engineer the projects, and then either they'll fund it with this money or other partners will use their own money to fund it. And then again, they obviously, there's a lot of they need that kind of expertise to work through that permitting process. So there is a lot of expertise that's needed, and that's what they provide. One of the other cool project is the Spring Road Conservation Project. That's subdivision 5B. That's money going to the Riley Purgatory Bluff Creek Watershed District in Hennepin County and Carver County. That's a 27-acre acquisition in Hennepin County, and they're buying some bluff land property in Eden Prairie, and it's not very often that you find those types of properties in the metro, especially like Eden Prairie or Chanhassen. I'm from Chanhassen, so I've seen the property, and there are rare species out there. But one of the interesting things is that Riley Creek runs through that property, and there's a slight tinge of purple in the water, and there's not very many creeks that have a slight tinge of purple, and that's because the headwaters of Riley Creek actually flows from Paisley Park in Chanhassen. And so, as we all know, that when it rains purple in Paisley Park, and it slowly makes its way down. No, I worked on that for about 2 weeks, Mr. Chair. And so
Mr. Pavelko, that can't be true. Is that the facts? Because it's pretty cool if it is.
Yeah. So those are just a few of the projects for this year's bill. There's literally thousands of projects with this money. Like I said, $150-some million. There's just a lot of work that can get done. I wanted to talk about the phase programs. So there's been questions about why is this phase? Why should the council talks about it a lot, but also, you know, these committees talk about the phase process. And I think it's we should think about it like this, that the money for OHF is actually in the ground work. This money goes from here into the ground to do basically habitat construction projects, you know. So it's pretty simple in nature. And so, you know, you're just moving the money from the, you know, administration part to the ground, you know, doing lots and lots of projects. And so the beginning of the OHF, there was a lot of discussion about should we bring 2,000 projects to the council every year, which are kind of basically the same types of projects. It's just wetland restoration and prairie restoration and forest restoration and those different types. Should we bring 2,000 of those and have all of that administrative cost, or should we bundle them into some sort of better, neater proposal type process, and then, you know, have less administration, less, you know, overhead costs? So right from the beginning, the council wanted, you know, these types of projects, these phase projects. So if you look at, like, let's just talk about subdivision 2E, accelerating the wildlife management area program, Pheasants Forever. So they have many acquisition projects in that one proposal. And so if they came to us the other way, there would be maybe 20 or 30 different proposals for each individual acquisition project, plus all of the restoration projects that go along with it. So it seems to make a lot more sense to do it that way instead of, again, having thousands of applications. And then there's two different types of phase projects. There's like more of a location-based, large project-based. So like the St. Louis River Estuary, the council has funded that. That's pretty, you know, pinpointed on the St. Louis Estuary. There's a whole bunch of projects within it, but they're, you know, they're geographically not very wide, and they're very specific to just cleaning up the St. Louis River Estuary. Whereas other projects, like the one I just talked about with the Pheasants Forever and their acquisition program, they're working in the entire southwest part of the state. They are location-based, and they're working to buy wildlife management areas, and those wildlife management areas have to meet certain standards, and they're looking for certain criteria when they're going out and acquiring those. So it's similar geography, very similar type projects. And the other thing, too, is that when you do this, you're keeping the project pipeline full, you know, so there is a lot of money and there are a lot of projects. And so you're keeping the project pipeline full. When you stop and start, there's always it's always hard to keep the projects in line and keep them going at a fast pace to spend the money and really make a difference. So there's a lot to it. The council has just felt, and especially staff have just felt, like it just makes the most sense to, you know, keep them as phase projects. We could call them something different, but you know, in reality, in the end, we're still going to be doing prairie restoration, wetland restoration, and forest work. So, Mr. Chair, I'll end there, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Pavelko, thank you very much for the detailed info as well. Representative Heinzman has a question, and then I do after you. So, Representative Heinzman.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Director and Assistant Director Pavelko. I do really like this handout that you did with the breakdown of acres across the state. It's been an ongoing conversation, and I know that it at times can be controversial. I like to see that the acres acquired appears to be fewer than in a number of other years, and that there seems to be a continued effort to add acres where there really isn't a lot of public land. The metro urban acres, I think, is a good example of an area where there should be some increased opportunity created by the fund. Mr. Pavelko, could you talk a little bit about how the acres acquired in this year's proposal may be different from previous years when Senator Green and I are on the council and trying to figure out a way to make sure that we're focusing those dollars in places where there's arguably a shortage of public land versus in other parts of the state, maybe Representative Scraba's district, where it just seems like there's huge amounts of public land and we continue to buy there, it seems. But maybe you could address that and compare. If you do have that, great. If you don't, we can, of course, talk about that offline.
Mr. Pavelko.
Mr. Chair and members, is the question how this year's total acres or specific acres compare to previous years? Mr. Chair and members, I do have that. So looking at total acres protect and fee with state PILT liability, that has ranged everywhere from 2,485 acres this year all the way up to last year, which the 2024 bill, which had 13,997. I would say on average, it's right around 5,000. I would say last year there was a large forest project that the DNR and the counties worked with to acquire some land. And that's why that 13,000 is so high. Looking at protect in fee without PILT liability, so again, that's going to either counties or the feds or cities or watershed districts. This year was 4,076, and that includes the large project with Itasca County, and that has ranged everywhere from 1,782 acres to the highest, which appears to be 6,544 acres over those years.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that expanded breakdown, Assistant Director. I'll just end with a comment that generally I believe there is a increasing appetite to take care of what we already have. And I'm glad to see that there appears to be in this bill a increased percentage of acres that are being restored or protected in easement. I think that's really a good way to get at that and maintain high quality lands for specific uses. That being said, I hope that we increase those numbers as opposed to the acquisition numbers. There's lots of good examples of areas where an acquisition makes sense, especially in areas where there's like I said earlier, less opportunity than in other parts of the state. And I'll probably leave my comments there for now, but it's long debated, hotly discussed issue at times, and I hope that those themes that I'm mentioning continue to have folks looking and trying to figure out ways to address those issues.
Very good, Representative Heinzman. Anything to comment on that? Okay, Mr. Pavelko, I have a question on the page, on the right-hand side of the page of the pamphlet you presented. You were mentioned the cost per acre for restoration and for the cost per acres, and you broke it down to per acre, and I didn't see where that numbers was. I was just curious, both in restore and to enhance.
Mr. Chair, members, I just did that offhand.
Oh,
that's on mine.
That
we
is
can
right.
Send those numbers if you'd like.
Sure, or if you want to just, can you repeat them just
oh,
real
yeah.
quick?
Or
just
sure.
write them down?
Mr. Chair and members, so this is, I'll preface this, that these are the total costs, so like staff costs, permitting costs, all of those costs that go into, producing 1 acre. So for restore, it's $2,570 an acre. And I'm just dividing the total acres on the left side by the total costs on the right there. So
sure.
$2,570 per acre for restore, $9,065 for protect and fee with pilt, $4,051 for protect and fee without pilt, $3,979 for protect and easement, and $630 for enhance.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Pavelko. We have a question from our DFL lead, Representative Vang. Vang, if you can hear us loud and clear.
Yes.
We can't see you, but we can hear you now, yes.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question on subdivision 25 regarding like the federal, leveraging federal grant. I'm wondering what type of conditions these grants can place on land use, and if these are new conditions that can supersede state law or existing practices.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Lead Vang, thanks for that question. The and it could be that Ms. Taylor will want to, may want to have her chime in on this as well, but basically those conditions that are come with the Pittman-Robertson funds, with the Dingell-Johnson, with the North American Wetland Conservation Act. Basically those conditions are that the land stays in conservation use in perpetuity. And that's the thing the council says, well, that's perfect. That's exactly what we want to be, and that's why the Outdoor Heritage Funds are being used there. Mr. Chair, it may be good for your legal counsel to chime in if they feel that's the right response.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Ms. Taylor?
Mr. Chair, members, that's basically correct. I think when Senate counsel and I looked into this, technically there's a provision that wouldn't allow the state to sell the land without federal approval. And to us, we felt that was an interest that was being conveyed to the feds, which would require, under our statutes, LSOHC approval. So we thought this clarification would be best.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. That makes sense. Mr. Pavelko?
Mr. Chair, members, I think the other thing to note is that it's because of the protection of the notice of funding restriction that's required in law. So if anybody acquires a parcel, they have to place a notice of funding restriction recorded on the deed. And that's the guarantee and the protection for the state's investment that if you buy this property, it needs to stay in permanent habitat protection in perpetuity. And you can't record anything else on that deed or change the intent of the OHF without getting permission from the council and then the legislature. So some of you will see emails from me about a conversion or a conveyance, like, a road needs to be widened. That's because of that protection with the notice of funding restriction that doesn't allow a change in that land unless it gets approved by the council and the legislature. And so that's what's that's why we're going through this, is because you can't record a federal funding restriction on that property, or probably not, without getting permission from the council. And so we're trying to work through that, knowing that both of the intent of the federal funding restrictions and the state restrictions are, you know, they work together.
Thank you, Mr. Pavelko. Yeah, very important protections for obviously protecting the land, but even equally in protecting the taxpayers, both federally and statewide. Representative Vang, do you have a follow-up as well? You have the floor.
No, that is all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A lot of good stuff for the district I represent in here. I mean, there's some. I do have a question about the Itasca land. What's the buy-in there for? What's the purpose of the land?
Mr. Chair?
Oh, sorry, I was looking at the summary here. Yes, Mr. Johnson.
All right, Mr. Chair and Representative Scraba, good question. That land currently is held by Boundary Waters Company, which is, it's working forest right now. Mm-hmm. They're looking at their land use projections for them are to divest of that property. They would like to see it stay in public, as a working forest. They'd like to see it be open to the public as well, because there's such a mishmash around it, such a patchwork around it, the federal, state, and county lands. And in the past, those properties, some of the federal and state properties and county lands have only been accessible through easement through Boundary Waters Company land. So this would allow that to, you know, allow better access to those properties. The county is planning on keeping it, as they want to call it, their memorial forest, but it's going to be in county ownership. The county will use it as working lands. They will be timberlands, and they're going to be managing for, depending on the type of property, type of soil types, and type of timber, I'm sure they're going to be managing it appropriate to the silviculture methods necessary.
Vice Chair Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. Following up on that, are there any private property owners that use that land for easement to get to them?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scraba, my understanding is no. I might be wrong, okay. but a private lander would still be able to access their properties then, as it's county ownership.
Vice Chair Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In northern Minnesota, sometimes having land like that keeps the public out, which the private property owner likes. But now if it's going to go public, does it affect their way of use of land? You know, I can probably talk to the land manager of Itasca County, get a better idea on that. But do you have any idea what the net loss of taxes are to the county or the state on those, when those private lands are, or is the Boundary Waters Company a nonprofit?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scraba, the Boundary Waters Company is not a nonprofit. They have been paying taxes on those properties. It's been commercial timberlands. I don't know that rate. I did hear at one point, but I don't remember the amount. There was something else you mentioned in that I was going to respond to, but I missed it.
Vice Chair Scraba.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The Moose Habitat, I'm going to switch gears on you, if I may. The Moose Habitat Collaborative, is that in the Fernberg Corridor? Do you know?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Representative Scraba, that Moose Habitat Collaborative is up in, I don't know if it comes down as far as St. Louis County. It does go up through Lake and into Cook County. There may be a little bit of St. Louis as well, but it's very, Fernberg, I believe, would probably be within the area.
It's all Lake County.
Yeah. But it wouldn't be exclusively in that. There's more area than that. They are looking at parcels, whether they are county, state, or federal parcels. And then, so they're working on public lands up there and enhancing those public lands.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Is this going to set up land sales to harvest trees to get Young Aspen for the moose, or what is the dollars for?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Scraba, that's really interesting because harvest, timber harvest is part of the natural land management plan up there. Mm-hmm. But in most cases, this may be where there's just stand dead spruce and it really needs to be, you know, take a dozer to it and knock it down and replant because of the spruce budworm, you know where that problem yep. up there is terrible. It may be areas like in Lake County, especially there were a number of areas where they had really sub-market stands of timber. It was really thin aspen, maybe some birch or whatever, mm-hmm. not enough to get a to pay a harvester to go in there and take it out. They couldn't sell bids on the property. This is an opportunity for them to go in and with outdoor heritage funds, they can actually do the harvest necessary, replant as needed, or through harvest stimulate that regrowth. And any product that's sold in that case, stumpage that's sold or whatever, those dollars will go right back into the mix to create more acres that would be enhanced.
Chair?
Thank you, Chair. So some of this property, some of these trees, I logged that corridor. I'm very familiar with it. The Forest Service had some cutaways in there where they'd go in and have people cut 40 acres, just drop it, lop and scatter, just leave it, move away. And it's right on the side, right next to the B-dub, right on the line. And they're doing that for wildlife habitat. And I call it mowing the grass, you know, going in there, just kind of maintaining the forest, mowing the grass, not really, there's no value in the trees. There's no, by the time you set a sail up and by the time you do everything, you're in the hole. Is that what this is kind of helping to, quote, mow the grass? And it also works as a fire suppression. I mean, there's all kinds of benefits here to do this. I'm just curious if that's exactly what's happening.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scraba, the impetus here, and this one especially, is to create moose habitat. So if it's just mowing the grass, no. It actually is, they're very specific in what they're doing in making sure that they're increasing the increasing the use and the quality of the habitat for moose. And it's been incredibly successful so far. If you go up, we had a picture last year on this. Oh, it's on here right now. Do you, on the bottom of yours, do you have on the lower left-hand of the front, do you have a picture? You don't.
I got ducks.
All right. And then we moved it off. This must be the earlier method of the model, but it's an area that they had done for moose, and there's just moose tracks like crazy going up into it in the snow. The Spear National Forest has been a really good partner on this in looking at specifically what's the habitat that needs to be there? How can we enhance it for moose? Fire is one of the things that on the fed lands is a larger use and that they're trying to implement. Unfortunately, you know, the weather dictates that. So there are years that they can't even get it done or the crews get pulled out west. But they're using all of the tools to increase the habitat, primarily for moose.
And to final up. And the reason I bring up the Fernbrig is I did log that. And when we were logging, there were hundreds of moose in there. And every time we'd come to the spring breakup, we'd be rushing to get going. And the moose were just literally walking around us. They didn't care that we were there because all that food was there for them. And it does work. It can work. And the sales down the road that we couldn't cut were all the federal spruce and they were getting everything out. So I'm hoping that everything goes well as planned. And I just want to say thank you for working with the Lake Superior on the trout rivers, that sort of thing. It's a big deal for a lot of folks on the North Shore for that. So I appreciate working on that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm good. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Vice Chair Scraba. Any other questions? Oh, Representative Hiltzley.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you so much to Representative Buckle and Lily for this. And as I continue to gain more knowledge in this space, so bear with me, I have about three questions. So I heard Representative Lilly talk about, you know, the projects being vetted, and I truly believe that. And so I'm curious to know, how has this bill taken into account the involvement of local communities, indigenous people, groups, conservation organizations, and other key stakeholders in decision-making process for the land selection? Just curious to know.
All right, gentlemen, who would like to take that answer? Representative Lilly, looks like you're queuing up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. A great question, and the projects are, like Representative Burkle offered during his kind of opening comments, are there's quite a few proposals that come to us, and so we look at those, and then we score them and vet them, and then whittle it down to a number, you know, to the number. But beyond that is, in the other part of your question is, how do people find out about it? And then I'd like to pass it to Mr. Johnson. But what the last few years, they've really done a great job of outreach. And I'm really proud of the work that's been done by the staff in particular to find new people that might be interested in this money. And then I was going to mention at kind of my closing about the CPL grants. And that's a great way to start for communities, whether it's your city councils or, you know, that might have a smaller project. And so there's other opportunities, and staff's great about that, of, you know, of working with people and trying to, they may be a no on the big funding, but, you know, we can find yeses in other ways, or maybe send them to Clean Water, or, and they've been helpful on that too. So that's kind of a rambling answer, but the CPL grant's been incredible. And Representative Fabian, your predecessor, and, you know, when I was on, we kind of started, but now it's up to like $12 million. And so there's a great opportunities for all your communities to have a variety of groups get involved and get funding and, you know, a smaller habitat project. Anyways, I'll pass. I'm sorry, I kind of went for a long answer.
Representative Lilly, you did not ramble. That was a very well stated. So thank you for your insight. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, thank you for the question. From an exposure standpoint, or from an access standpoint, making sure that people know about the funds, as Representative Lilly had mentioned, has always been kind of primary in our mind. Our call for funding requests goes out April 1 and ends about the end of May each year. Each year in at that time, we make sure that we send out all of the cities and all of the counties across the state get a letter from us specifically saying our call for funding requests is opening up. And it's this much money is going to be available that we know of, and we encourage you to please apply or call us or email us, and we will come and meet with you if you'd like, because we want to make sure that people know. And we do that. In fact, and we do that year round. In the last couple months, in the last few months, I've met with several cities and some counties about potential projects that they have. Okay. Nonprofits sometimes will call us as well, and at a lesser rate than city than local units of government. And watershed districts, soil water conservation districts also. And we do send a separate email and to all of the watershed districts and soil and water conservation districts across the state. We send it to AMC and as well, and so make sure it's exposed. We also put our call for funding request notification in publication, electronic, mm-hmm. And also printed publications across the state and in the region, in the greater Great Lakes region. The reason is because, you know, maybe a Wisconsin paper is read in Minnesota, mm-hmm. or vice versa. So we want to make sure everything's incorporated. So we try to pull out the stops to make sure people know, and then we try to do whatever we can to answer the questions, which gives me a wonderful opportunity to say to you and the rest of the members here what I often say and can't say enough, is if you have constituents who are local units of government or they're nonprofits or whoever in your district who you think could benefit by these dollars, please have them contact me or give me their information and I can contact them. We would be glad to meet with them, and if I think I have a meeting in a day or two out more in the western suburbs with another potential recipient who wants to ask some questions. So I hope that answers your question, ma'am. Oh,
absolutely.
Also, within these applications, there are, you mentioned tribal. Tribal interests are intimate members in a number of these. Like the Moose Habitat Collaborative was one. 1854 Treaty Authority, the Fond du Lac Band. I think the Grand Marais, I mean Grand Portage Band, and there may be another one or two up there as well. Boys Fort, yes. Okay. And then there are other projects as well where they are involved as well. The CPL grants are probably more where our tribal members will get involved in actually mm-hmm. receiving the funds themselves, because those are smaller, you know, $500,000 or less. And just for the to let you know from a metro standpoint, my records that I have right now, kind of a what's been done already in the metro, there's been about 123,000 acres in the metro that have in the seven or nine county metro area or the Duluth, Rochester, St. Cloud, that have been touched by outdoor heritage dollars, either protected, restored, or enhanced. And that comes to about, I think it's $111 million in appropriations to those areas. So it's a chunk of money.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Momani Hilsley. Did I say that right?
Yes, you did. Thank
Fantastic.
You.
Fantastic.
It's like more money, Momani.
Momani, okay. Yeah. I love it. That's a perfect for this committee.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Yes, thank you so much for that. You definitely gave me more than I was anticipating, but I truly appreciate that context. And then my next question is in regards to sustainability, and especially with the legacy up for a vote, I think, in 2030-something. I'm wondering what plans are in place to ensure the long-term management and maintenance of the lands acquired or enhanced through this initiative, and how will the ongoing funding look like from you guys' end?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Momani, is that correct?
Yes, thank you.
Sorry, that's my first attempt, so my apologies if I didn't quite get it right. Yes, of course, from a standpoint of conservation easements, every time you'll see in a number of these appropriations that have easements involved that there is stewardship and enforcement dollars that are set aside. Okay. Those monies go into a funds or into accounts that are held in perpetuity, so that those easements can be managed or monitored and enforced, if necessary, in perpetuity, either by, like, the Minnesota Land Trust or by the DNR or by Bowser. So that's kind of that from a sustainability of the easement standpoint, making sure that they're being sustained moving forward. For state lands that are acquired, it's up to the state to continue those forward. While there are funds coming through from Outdoor Heritage, while this outdoor heritage, these funds are available. These funds are used through the roving crews and others to help to manage those properties moving forward. The what's going to happen in 2034 when the fund expires? I'm sure there are people that hope that it will be extended. I'm sure there are people that hope that it will not. But you know, that's everybody gets their choice. I'm a nonpartisan staff, so I actually can't weigh in one side or the other for that. I'll be retired by then, I sure hope. But that's hopefully long before then. So maybe I'll be involved in it then. But right now, I'm nonpartisan staff, ma'am.
Thank you.
Representative Momani Hilsley.
Last question for the group here. So thank you, Chair. And then lastly, I think about the association with federal grants. And so I'm wondering what potential risks are associated with leveraging state lands for federal grants? That's what I meant to say. And have you thought about, you know, how to address this, if there are any that you guys see?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thanks. Interesting question. I think Mr. Pavelko hit it pretty well in the head a little bit ago, that when, let's say, when a North American Waterfall Conservation Act dollars are leveraged to a WMA enhancement. The notice of funding restriction that's on that property with outdoor heritage funds already says these lands have to stay in conservation in perpetuity. Any change to that has to come back to the council, has to be approved by the council and the legislature, et cetera. The NACA dollars will have that caveat on there that's attached to their terminology, whatever that's attached to their dollars. It says these lands have to stay in conservation in perpetuity as well. If the state were to say, for some reason, that, you know, we want to sell that property, we've decided that highest and best use is going to be making it into swamp front property or something, I don't know. If the state were going to do that, the federal government then would be able to say, no, with our leverage of the federal funds, you have to get our approval as well for you to do that. So that's the conveyance of interest that is conveyed. And every money has some type of tails or some expense to it. And so that's it. The good thing in this place is that the intent of those dollars and the intent of the outdoor heritage dollars is the same. It's to keep it in conservation. And if there were a reasonable expectation for changing the purpose, I think the feds would probably look at it the same, and the feds would say, now you got to replace it somewhere else, as is another part of their leverage.
Okay, members, we do have another bill, but there are a few more questions, so let's just keep it more cogent, if you can, and for our testifiers as well. Representative Chau.
Thank you, Chair. Just a simple question. How would you guys rate the conditions of our wetlands and heritage forest habitats? Are there a lot of areas behind it, or are we doing enough, or are there areas we can do more in?
All right, Mr. Pavelko, you look like the lucky winner here.
Mr. Chair and members, that is such an easy question. I think from a habitat perspective, based on the habitat itself, there's parts of the state that are really good and maybe don't need any Outdoor Heritage Fund help. And there are other parts of the state that are not good, and that's where a lot of those Outdoor Heritage Fund dollars are, being invested in. There's not a lot of wetland restoration being done in northeast part of the state because their watersheds are relatively intact, where if you go down to southwest Minnesota, there's a lot of wetland restoration being done and a lot of associated adjoining upland work being done as well for restoration to, not only restore the wetlands, but also try and make sure that the wetlands that are being restored provide quality habitat. And again, it really depends. Some people think that we have enough habitat in the state, and there's other people that think there's not enough. I will also, Mr. Chair, it really is a perspective based on, obviously species and location of state and different things, but I'd say it varies across the state.
Very good. Representative Chau, a follow-up?
Well, thanks for the answer, and I appreciate what this committee does, and continue to take care of Minnesota. Thank you.
So at this point, Representative Burkle and Representative Lilly, do you have any closing remarks before I close it out with a vote?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's an honor to be on this with Representative Burkle and amazing, citizens and volunteer to be on the commission and vet these projects with the staff. And it's always fun to me to say that, we have, I don't know if you've heard the name Ron Chera, but Ron Chera is one of the members that's on there. And if, he clearly cares about, like all the members do, care about the habitat and restoring it and being successful and making Minnesota better with these funds. And so they're very well vetted and looked at. Kind of backing up to the original question from Representative Heitzman, and it's kind of what we heard with the Parks and Trails. I think they are trying to do a better job with the roving crew and other things and, spending a lot more money protecting what we have out there and restoring it and enhancing it. And there is a lot less buying. There's opportunities that pop up. So like that forest pops up and you hate to miss that chance. So then, you kind of have to do it when it happens, but there is a lot more money, and I believe the council has really listened and moved the needle to invest a lot more in the prairie parts of the state than I think earlier on it was a lot more in Representative Scraba's district, and quite honestly, they're not wrong. It was heavily skewed that way, and I think they've really made an effort to hear the legislators and the, you know, to spread it around, and we are a big state. The CPL program, again, is just amazing, and I really encourage all the members to look at that, and, you know, if you do have questions, to reach out to the members, but there's amazing work that's done in that space now. And then I just wanted to, again, thank staff. They do a great job on this, and then they are accessible. So if you ever have questions, call Mr. Johnson or Joe, and they'll answer questions and maybe shoot in a different direction, like you know, to find funding to succeed, like I mentioned earlier. And then I would just, as Mr. Chair, and then, you know, the two chair, you know, however, whatever, but Representative Ain and yourself, I hope you look backwards too, because like last year we funded the Lock and Dam program, and I hope you look back at some of the things, because I think it'd be good for this council to hear what we did, you know, with Representative Heitzman's help and others to succeed and, you know, to go after the carp in this space. I mean, it's really a crucial thing for our habitat to stop as best we can to stop that in Minnesota, and we kind of did that with these funds last year, and I hope you kind of look at that for the future. Sorry.
Very good, Representative Lilly. Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll make things quick here, but do want to chime in on the staff and the invasive carp comment. Very good comment there, Representative Lilly. Just quickly, this year's package was unanimously approved by the Lassard Sams Council, and I think what we've presented to you is worthy of support, and so I'll just renew my motion to re-refer this to Ways and Means.
Very good. Thank you, gentlemen, for the presentation. Very transparent, and being a critic for the legacy funds from the beginning, an outdoor heritage, Lassard Sams being one of my top on the list. I've been like a sponge the last month or so, absorbing what you've done and meeting with you outside of the chambers in the meeting as well. And I think it's evident that you're doing great work. And these programs are vetted, and we trust and see with our own eyes and ears how good they are. Just real quickly before we take the vote, Mr. Pavelko is helping us out in Wright County on some preservation, restoration, and habitat preservation. So they are very willing to help, and with districts that need it, and get this money out to Minnesota. And if you haven't watched Home Minnesota Bound with Ron Shearer, turn the TV on. He does a wonderful job, he and his daughter. So I think that's all I had at this point, because we do have the Historical Society to present with us.
Mr. Chair.
And are we listening to?
My apologies, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask you real quick, if you can state the intent of the bill pathway before we take the vote.
Yes, I was just about to do that, Representative Vang. Thank you. Representative Burkle renews his motion that House File 1250 be recommended to be referred to the Fine Committee of Ways and Means. And we will be taking a roll call, since there's some folks on the Zoom, so we all know who voted what. So with that in mind, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair McDonald?
Aye.
Vice Chair Scraba?
Aye. Aye.
Representative Burkle?
Aye.
Representative Chaw?
Aye.
Representative DePell? Representative Heinzman?
Aye.
Representative Hussein is excused. Representative Lilly?
Aye.
Representative Mamani Hiltzley?
Mamani Hiltzley, aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shong?
Shong votes aye. Did you get that? I didn't.
Got it.
We got it. All right, thanks, Ms. Nelson. The vote passed, 9 votes in aye, so motion carries. And no nays, no naysayers in this committee. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Representatives, thank you for the bill. We look forward to seeing this as it continues to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I guess I didn't have to slam that. Okay. Next, we have an overview from the Minnesota Historical Society. And we have Mr. David Kelleher, who is with the Public Policy and Government Relations for the Minnesota Historical Society, joined with Kent Whitworth, Director of CEO of the MHS, and then Avi Viswasthian, why not? Give it a try. Executive Vice President, Mission Delivery for Minnesota Historical Society. So, Mr. Kelleher, do you want to go first, or whoever wants to, introduce your name for the record, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Leadman Mervang. My name is Kent Whitworth. I serve as the Director and CEO of the Minnesota Historic Society, as you said. My colleagues joining me are David Kelleher, Vice President for Public Policy, Government Relations, and then Avi Viswanathan, who is our Executive Vice President for Mission Delivery. We are delighted to be with you today to share briefly the accomplishments that have been made possible by the Legacy Amendment History Funds, and also to share the history community's request for the next biennium. And maybe most importantly, our message is a huge heartfelt thanks from the Minnesota Historical Society and the entire history community for your past support. I hope by now most everybody, if not everyone, has received a hard copy of the latest legacy report, and if not, we can make those available. Those are all available online as well, going back since the origination of this program. I will quickly point out to you a couple of high-level facts at the at-a-glance page. I think it's important to know that for just $3 per Minnesotan, we across the state have the benefit of a wide range of history activities, and we will highlight a few of those this morning. Another thing, I'd like to touch on the ROI, the return on investment, which is right at 100%. So for every history legacy dollar invested, Minnesota receives a $2 return on that investment, which obviously directly benefits the state and local economies. Certainly, Minnesota Historic Society does not do this work alone, and you see just a list of the Minnesota History Coalition that carries out this work. And you may have had the opportunity to interact with a number of members of our coalition last week at History Matters Day, our 19th annual History Matters Day. And with that, I will hand off to Mr. Kelleher to talk a little bit about the model, the structure for these history legacy funds.
Thank you, Mr. Kelleher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Lead Vang, members of the committee, David Kelleher, Minnesota Historical Society. Wanted to show you how legacy history funds are structured in appropriations bills in years past. And this image, of course, starts with the language that's in the Minnesota Constitution to preserve Minnesota's history and cultural heritage. And of course, we think that that's pretty cool to have the words to preserve Minnesota's history in the Constitution. From there, you make appropriations for these purposes, and in years past, you have structured that in the way that's shown on this outline. We'll spend a fair chunk of our time this morning talking about the grants program, the statewide historical and cultural heritage grants. The next grouping is statewide programs, and those are things that are run by the Minnesota Historical Society. There's a category for statewide history partnerships, and this is where organizations can work together to accomplish a history project and contribute either financial resources or expertise and come together and learn from each other. And we'll spend just a minute on each of those. The fourth and fifth are the Archaeological Survey and the Minnesota Digital Library. So this chart is included in your report as well, and this shows the appropriations that were made in the last biennium for each of these project areas. We'll start with the grants program, the Statewide Historical and Cultural Heritage Grant Program. This is a competitive grants program. It's reviewed by a citizen committee, volunteers from around the state who bring their expertise in the reviews of the applications. We have successfully administered 3,400 grants over the life of the Legacy Amendment, and those have gone to all 87 counties across the state. And these are for things, history programs such as museum collections and the environments in which they live, public programs, exhibits, and then preserving historic structures. And you see on this image the Tower Minnesota Fire Hall Preservation Project is one of the grants. The grants program is broken up into small grants, $10,000 or less, and large grants, over $10,000. The small grants are available 3 to 4 times a year, and the large grants once a year. Same words, different pictures. On this image, you can see the Delano Village Hall received a couple of grants, and you can see sort of the before and after picture where they did some work on the exterior, and the current grant for that project is to improve accessibility with an elevator and some other improvements to make sure that that building is accessible to all. Mr. Chair, you can see here an image of the Historic Resources Advisory Committee. That's the volunteer citizen group, 15 members, that makes recommendations for the grant applications. They bring that to the Minnesota Historical Society's governing board, the Executive Council, and they bring their expertise in areas such as historic preservation, archaeology, local history, museum work, and archival work. In 2024, the Historic Resources Advisory Committee members contributed more than 500 hours. They read every application. There's an online program, and they deliberate just like you do, or the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, on what the best projects are. They score the projects, and you can see in this image, they're having a look at the spreadsheet up on the big screen and make those tough decisions. There's usually a 2-to-1 ratio of applications to dollars available, so they make the tough decisions for us. Included in your booklet is a map of the state of Minnesota that shows the grants in a couple of different ways. This image is the number of grants by county, and this image is the dollars per capita by county. That this is over the life of the legacy amendment. 998 different organizations in all 87 counties have received grants. And since the life of the legacy amendment, $83 million have been distributed to history organizations, but other organizations that you might not think of as primarily a history organization, but they're doing history work. Mr. Chair, we're going to spend a little bit of time, and in the interest of time, I'll go through this very quickly, but I know the legislature this year is spending a lot of time on grants management. We are happy to talk about how we do this work in whatever detail you like offline, and maybe not right now today, but we think that we do a very thorough job in reviewing the applications and monitoring those grants after they go through. This diagram shows the life of a grant from an idea through consultation with the grants office, application process and reviews, and then, as we described earlier, the Historic Resources Advisory Committee, and then finally a grant agreement and monitoring. So a couple of highlights. Our grants office produces a grants manual for each of the grants programs, and this is the manual for legacy programs that it lists categories and all the requirements that grantees have to follow. It includes a glossary of terms so that people are clear on what the expectations are and information about the financial requirements, the reporting requirements, and the record keeping. And that grants manual is revised based on feedback from the field and the Historic Resources Advisory Committee. Our staff provide pre-grant workshops, and the question earlier about outreach and community with the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, these are coming from community, from organizations with people who are working on those projects within local communities. We have seminars for successful applicants, and we do site visits and ongoing help for grantees and applicants. Once a grant agreement is signed, there's ongoing monitoring. Grants over $50,000 require a site visit or a presentation, depending on the type of the work that's done, and interim reporting before final payment is made. And depending on the project. If it's a historic building, like you saw in the previous slide, a site visit will look at what was done. If it's an exhibit, the site visit will take a look at that. Or if it's a book, they'll submit the book. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I'll hand it back to Director Whitworth.
Mr. Chair, the next bucket, if you will, of funds that MNHS administers is the statewide programming, and this is the statewide programming is, as David said, managed by the Minnesota Historic Society. I'd like to just touch on that, but before I do, because it is administered by MNHS, I think it's relevant for us to point out the mission statement. And there are any number of very strategic words in this statement, but for us, that third word, all Minnesotans, is very important. And then about two-thirds of the way down, you'll see the word curiosity. We feel like curiosity is a key for people of all perspectives and all levels of understanding of history to have. That curiosity is enabling us to really engage in meaningful ways at the individual level, at the community level, certainly at the state level. So just wanted to have that framing. And just a little more context before I move forward. These are the four strategic imperatives of our current strategic plan. We're about 3.5 years into this plan, and you see those key concepts ranging from access all the way to sustainability. And so these are those guiding priorities for MNHS, and you will see that reflected in these statewide programs. One other way to look at this is through the lens of preserving or sharing or connecting. And so I'll highlight just a few examples of how these statewide programs emphasize preserving. I'll point out our newspaper programming. The digitization of Minnesota newspapers is a national model, frankly. We've got some 7 million pages of Minnesota newspapers on our digital hub, and that's from all shapes and sizes. It's in multiple dozens of languages and spans from pre-statehood almost to the present. So we're very grateful for the support for that newspaper digitization program. Obviously, there are other collections-related preservation efforts that are supported by legacy. The let's move on to the next category of sharing. We tend to define that as exhibitions. Many of you have seen various exhibitions at the History Center and local history museums around the state, but images here you see from a few years ago, our First Avenue exhibition marking a commemorative anniversary for First Ave. There's also the entry to a new exhibit at historic Fort Snelling that focuses on many voices, many stories, one place. A couple of images here from a few of our other recent exhibitions, We Are Hmong and Somali Plus Minnesota exhibition. So a great way for us to connect with various communities, regardless of how you define that. That third lens through which you might think about our statewide history programming is connecting. And here we tend to lean into the work that we do with formal education, particularly K-12, where you see everything from curriculum development to support for field trips to remove barriers so that people, so classes can come, whether it's the admission fee or the transportation cost. And we also have programs that are aimed at high school and undergraduates. And I'll just point out that at MNHS, we've got some four-legged colleagues that help deliver history experiences to the people of Minnesota and beyond. And you see one of the draft horses there from Forest History Center in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and we've been able to build out that horse program thanks in part to the Legacy Program. And so that's just a few, another photograph from the exhibit at Fort Snelling, but that just gives you a broad overview of those state history programs that are presented by MNHS, thanks in large part to Legacy.
Thank you, Mr. Whitworth. And Mr. Keller, who is next?
Up next, Mr. Chair, in the legacy bill that you all passed 2 years ago, you included a provision to encourage all of us to provide better access to Minnesotans who for whom cost to visit places might be a barrier. And here's the language that was in the legacy bill 2 years ago. So we wanted to update you with a couple of examples of things that we've been doing to make sure that cost is not a barrier for people to visit our locations. The Museums for All program is a national program coordinated by the federal agency, the Institute for Museum and Library Services. So you can go to their website and look up museums all around the country that offer free or reduced admission to people for whom income may be an issue. We have instituted 4 free days, sort of based on the DNR's model of state parks, where they have free days at parks spread throughout the year. And then we have sort of reinstituted free Thursday evenings at the Minnesota History Center, which we have had before, but we brought that back. Mr. Chair, the third category in these 5 buckets is history partnerships that I mentioned earlier, where organizations can work together on a history project and share expertise. You see a list of some of the partners. Sometimes those partnerships are with the Minnesota Historical Society, and then sometimes we are not part of those partnerships. Organizations just work together on a history project. You see an image of the Northern Bedrock Historic Preservation Corps doing some work at the Halfway Ranger Station up in Ely. The Archaeological Survey mentioned earlier, and the Digital Library, go through that. Avi's up next.
Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Vishwanathan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to speak to one specific grant program that we administered last year through a one-time appropriation from the legislature to commemorate 50 years of Southeast Asians in Minnesota. We were appropriated $400,000 for that grant program. We received 37 applications that were reviewed by our HREC committee with requests around $2 million. That meant we gave out grants for $400,000 out of $2 million of requests. That made this particular, and 11 grantees selected, that made this particular grant program the most selective that we have operated at the Minnesota Historical Society, with roughly 20% of the requested funds being allocated in grants and under 30% of the applications being awarded grants. In addition to those 11 grantees, in order to make sure that all Southeast Asian communities were included in these in the grants that were given or funds that were given from the Historical Society, we entered into partnership agreements similar to the history partnerships that David just spoke to, with organizations from the Vietnamese, Lao, and Cambodian communities as well. So we were able to use history partnership funding and Special Guerrilla Unit veterans. So we were able to use partnership funds to supplement the $400,000 to be able to be inclusive of all of our different communities. And that work will take place during the course of this year and includes oral history projects, storytelling to make sure that those communities that don't have written stories have an opportunity, exhibit banners, and other things that will live on past this 50th anniversary.
So, Mr. Chair, I now present to you in this slide the request from the Minnesota Historical Society and Minnesota's history community for the upcoming biennium. You see the totals there for historic and cultural grants, the competitive grant program. The request is for the biennium, $26 million. We have the same number for statewide history programs, $26 million. The history partnerships request is $7.5 million for the biennium. And the statewide survey of historical and archaeological sites is $1 million, as is the Minnesota Digital Library. And you'll see below there that these are based on what is estimated as 33% of the Arts Cultural Heritage Fund. This is, frankly, a stretch request, but given the allocation, the Constitution, 47%, almost 50% for arts. We felt like it was appropriate for us to request one-third of that fund for history across the state of Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair, with that, we stand ready to address questions.
Very good. Thank you, gentlemen. We are a little short of time, but we're not going to finish up just yet because we have some questions. Representative Bjorn Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the one area where I feel like I can actually talk in this committee and know what I'm talking about. A little history about myself. I was a history teacher for a number of years. I've got a master's in history. And the interesting thing that I want to make sure that the Minnesota Historical Society continues to move forward in is the concept that my students had no idea what color my political campaign sign was until it was out on the lawn. In class, I would equally discuss both sides of an issue and make sure that I tried to thread a very fine needle. It's important that as a state agency or as a society, we ensure that all arguments are provided, and the individual who's receiving the information has the ability to determine for themselves what the right side of each issue is. And I know it's really difficult in history to present all sides in a fair and accurate way. But with that being said, I want to commend you on some of the work you've done, especially the digitization of all this information. We need to make sure that our students and our citizens here in the state of Minnesota understand who they are as Minnesotans and understand their history. But it's also incredibly important that everyone around the world understands the history of Minnesota. And the better and more accessible that information is to people outside of our state, the better we can project on them what it truly is like to be a Minnesotan. I know when I was writing my 135-page thesis, it was very beneficial when I was able to go online and find access to information in Virginia without actually having to go to Virginia. But then when I would go to a website in Pennsylvania and try and find a piece of information from them, I would have had to go to Pennsylvania to read the letter from the individual, and it was just not possible. So the better we are of pushing Minnesotans' history out there, the better. So I really commend you on that.
I couldn't agree more, Representative Olson. Thank you. Representative Chaw?
I'll keep it brief, Chair. Thank you. First of all, thank you to this committee and its member in regards to the funds that were appropriate for the 50th anniversary of Southeast Asian in the state of Minnesota. All history is important, but I'm going to speak in regards to my heritage and history in the state of Minnesota because I think that's very important. It's important because to be a Hmong American, Minnesota is the best place to be, and I think it's the only place to be if you're a Hmong American. It's the only state where you will see that you will have 3 senators and 6 House members who are of Hmong descent. And that's something to say for. I want to thank Director Kent and your team on working with the legislator in regards to these grants. I wish we had more money, but, and that's the case for all the programs that means a lot to all of us. And so I want to thank you for the work and your team and the sensitivity and understanding, communities, the work that you put into it. So I really appreciate that. This is the 50th year anniversary for Hmong Americans being in America after the fall of, the Secret War of Laos. And I am reminded, because I was born after the year, and it was 76. So for every year that I'm alive, I think of the day that my parents had to leave Laos, right? And we became refugees. Mm-hmm. And what's important and significant in regards to the history and the heritage for Hmong Americans in Minnesota is that this is all that we have left. We don't have any history or anything that's left in China or in Laos or Thailand that resembles the true history of our people and our struggle. And everything that we are building today and leaving today will be for our children and for others to understand us as a community and as people. And so I want to thank the History Center for continuing on that preservation of my culture, language, and heritage, and that it's not only important for my community, but it's for all Minnesotans. But because I am Hmong, I'm going to speak to my part, and so thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Chair, very important. History matters for sure. Gentlemen, please don't take the lack of time for the importance of your mission. It's very important to us, Minnesota. And we have another question, but before I call on that person, if there is a window of time in our committee that we have an opening, we may ask you back if we have more questions, because history matters. Particularly, of course, I am thankful for that building in Delano, the old Village Hall, which is right across the street from my 100-year-old studio building. So I've been watching that building proceed for many, many years. Oh, Representative Jay Zhang, welcome. I didn't even see you sneak in.
Thank you, Representative.
You have a question. Remember, we have to be at the House floor here.
Mr. Chair, we'll keep this very quick. I just wanted to thank my constituent, Avi, and apologize for not responding to your text message about whether Legacy was going to happen or not. I was in the middle of the Veterans Committee, so I did not see your text message, though. Just want to make sure that I have that on record saying I'm sorry.
Very good, Representative Zhang. That is very important. Okay, gentlemen, so again, perhaps if there's a window of opportunity to have you come back. Otherwise, you can certainly meet with us at another time. I personally would like to meet with you folks, Mr. Keller as well, talk more about the issues and the bill. And if there's no further business, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.